Well, if you turn back to the passage we read from the book of Judges at chapter 11, and we're going to be looking this morning at that portion from verse 1 through verse 28. Just to remind you what happened in the last chapter. Chapter 10 was in many ways a very depressing chapter. It charts Israel's continued slide into sin and apostasy. We find in that chapter that following the deaths of these two judges, Tola and Jair, Israel turns aside from their God yet again. It says, verse 6 of chapter 10, "Then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of their Lord." And the extent of their departure from God is spelt out to us in that verse. They served the Baals and the Ashtaroths, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. We have that list of the idols they embrace from every point of the compass, from all the surrounding lands. They departed from the Lord their God, and they did so with a reckless abandonment. And because of this, God sent them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. And as you read that chapter, you find that for 18 long years they oppressed and harassed the children of Israel. And that continued until Israel cried out to the Lord in their distress. They put away their foreign gods and they cast themselves upon God unreservedly to do with them as he saw fit. And that's really the position as we come to the end of chapter 10. The one ray of hope, the beam of light that shines out from that sad chapter are the words towards the end of verse 16, where it says of God, "His soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel." He would help them. And chapter 11 will reveal to us how that help arose and how God in his wonderful providence undertook for his people. But Israel by now is in a very low place indeed. You see in this chapter there's the threat of further invasion by the Ammonites. They've encamped against Israel at Gilead. Chapter 10, verse 17, "Then the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead." But all the years of oppression and hardship and pillaging had left Israel without any natural leader. And verse 18 of chapter 10 finds the people, the leaders of Gilead, really at a loss as to what to do. They're scratching their heads, as we say. What should they do? They ask, "Who is the man who will begin the fight against the people of Ammon?" They're asking, to whom can we turn? Because there's really no one left in Israel who seemed remotely equipped or indeed willing to take up the role of their leader. In other words, there's a power vacuum in the land. What could be done? Well, there is a man who will fill the gap, and the opening verses of chapter 11 introduce us to him with the words, "Now, Jephthah the Gileadite," and then we're told, "a mighty man of valor." But although he's a mighty man of valor, he has certain disadvantages, because the verse goes on to say, he was the son of a harlot. He's the son of a prostitute. And because of this, we're told his half-brothers, when they become old enough to think about wealth and money, decide to banish Jephthah. They disown him so that he will not have any part in his father's inheritance. So we read at verse 3, "Because of this, Jephthah fled from his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tob." Now, I put it to you, if ever there was a man with good reason to have a chip on his shoulder, it's this man. It seemed that life had been particularly unfair to him. He didn't ask, did he, to be born of a harlot? He didn't ask either to have such selfish and ruthless half-brothers. He certainly didn't ask to be an outcast. But Jephthah is also a man with natural leadership qualities. And you read in this chapter, he's a man around whom very soon other men with a sad tale to tell gather around him. Verse 3, worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him. He becomes a sort of bandit figure, a man who is living off his wits, roaming around the countryside with his marauding band of thugs. I suppose today you call them soldiers of fortune. Here's Jephthah then. He's living, as it were, on the fringe of society. He's been rejected by his own family. He's the classic loser. He's the no-hoper. But this period in exile, living from day to day, having to fight for everything he had, constantly on the alert, looking over his shoulder for enemies who would have taken his life, meant he had developed into a shrewd and effective leader. A man who, although clearly rough and ready, was yet a man of considerable strength and resourcefulness and courage. And because, over and above everything else, as we learn in this chapter, he was to be God's man. He was to be God's man. A man who, through all these events of life, the rough and tumble of life, would be ready to fulfill the role of Israel's deliverer when he was called to do it. But the point is this, isn't it? Who would have thought it? Who would have thought it? He was a mighty man of valor, as we're told there at verse 1. But, but, and what a but. He was the son of a harlot. He was an outcast from society. He was a bandit figure, the leader, indeed, as we're told, of a group of worthless men. Men who, no doubt, made the lives of others a misery. Now, before we move on to consider how the elders of Gilead approached Jephthah and then his response to them, let's consider this thought. We've considered it before as we've gone through Judges, but we need to consider it again. God sometimes chooses unlikely men to be leaders. As I say, it's not Jephthah that he's an isolated case. We've already looked at Gideon hiding away from the Midianites and being told he's a mighty man of valor. Who, me? Who, me? Later in Israel's history, you'll remember David would be passed over as a natural leader, as their king. What, that boy looking after sheep? The next king? The future king? Others of God's great men have been found in strange places. You can think of Elijah, the great prophet. He didn't come from the most auspicious of regions. He came from Gilead, a rocky, barren backwater. That was his training ground, as it were. And I mention this again because there is a danger that the church can be guilty today of bypassing, of neglecting men with gifts and ability for office because they don't come from the right background. I've mentioned before, I think it's a true story of a church members meeting who were having serious reservations about a man's suitability to become an elder in the church. And the problem was, as somebody put it, but he's only a carpenter. He's only a carpenter. How can he be an elder? And it wasn't until someone who'd obviously read the Bible pointed out to this particular individual, you know, that the Son of God was a carpenter, the carpenter of Nazareth, that the folly of the objection was exposed. Some years ago, someone wrote the following. This is a sort of imaginary memorandum written to Jesus by a firm of management consultants in Jerusalem. And it's a memorandum as to the suitability of Christ's disciples. I found this quite, it's amusing, but it's also interesting. And among other things, these management consultants wrote this. Simon Peter is emotionally unstable and given to fits of temper. Andrew has absolutely no qualities of leadership. The two brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, place personal interest before company loyalty. Thomas demonstrates a questioning attitude that would tend to undermine morale. Doubting Thomas, is he? And we feel it's only our duty to tell you that Matthew has been blacklisted by the Greater Jerusalem Better Business Bureau. Because he was tax collecting for the Romans. James, the son of Alphaeus and Theudas, definitely has radical leanings. And it ends by saying this, the one man with great potential of ability and resourcefulness, who is highly motivated and ambitious, is Judas. It underlines the fact, doesn't it? God's ways are not ours. In his first letter to the Corinthians, at chapter 1, and at verses 26 through 29, the Apostle Paul tells us this. He says, not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things which are despised God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. One thing is certain, this man Jephthah would be out of sight as a potential leader of God's people today. His background a tremendous hindrance. Now it's possible that Christians today may feel that because of your background, because of your particular circumstances, because of some setback that you've had in life, that you're somehow disqualified from service, from serving God. There are some believers I've met over the years who are prone to say, if only, if only. If only I'd not missed that opportunity all those years ago. If only I had a more understanding father or mother. If only this event hadn't happened to me. If only I had more gifts. Then I would be better equipped to serve God. And that can be a real snare. And some have fallen into self-pity, and it consumes their souls and blights their lives, even as believers. But of course, we need to recognize this. God knows the circumstances of his people. He knows all the difficulties and all the trials we've ever had to undergo. And yet, he's received us, sinners that we are. And he's received us just as we are. And he's chosen us to go forth and to bring forth fruit, even as he chose his disciples of old for that very end. So don't be cast down. Don't think, as some believers do, well, there's nothing I can do. What have I to offer God? Because I say to you, the circumstances of your life, under the hand of an all-wise God of providence, have equipped you uniquely uniquely, my friend, to be able to serve him and others. Let's learn from Jephthah. Let's learn from him when we're considering the appointing of spiritual leaders, not to pass over people because of their background, their past history, but to apply the biblical tests as to their suitability. But also as individual Christians to recognize that the God who saved us has had his hand upon our lives from the cradle. Indeed, he's had his hand upon our lives from all eternity. And he's taught us in all the events of life, in the crucible of life, that we may serve him and others. He knew these things. Think of this, think of what the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians 1:4. He said, God comforts us in all our tribulation, in all these trials we go through, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. But what I'm saying here, this applies to you, is this: don't let your past cripple your future. See God's hand of providence in all the affairs of your life and rest in his mercy and his forgiveness and his love. And then go out and show the same grace and the same love to others. We better move on to verses 4 through 11, which tell us all about the process of negotiation that led to Jephthah becoming the head and the commander of Israel. Indeed, their deliverer, their judge. Before we consider the verses in more detail, we ought to note that there's something remarkable happening here. Back in chapter 10, Israel had rejected God, yet God delivered his people. And that's now echoed, as it were, and illustrated by the fact that the Gileadites reject Jephthah, yet Jephthah is to deliver them. And the parallel is surely not by accident. The similarities are striking. The Israelites, when in distress, cry out to the Lord, verse 10, chapter 10. And here in this chapter, the elders of Gilead call out to Jephthah in verse 6, come and be our commander. And both the Lord's reply in chapter 10, and verses 11 through 14, and Jephthah's in verse 7 of chapter 11 show that both realize that someone is trying to use them. The way that the Gileadites treat Jephthah is a sort of acted parable of the way Israel had treated their God. Jephthah had been unjustly treated, so had the Lord, by the people's turning away from him and their worshipping other gods. Yet both come to Israel's aid. Here's God at work. And of course the pattern is ultimately seen in the New Testament in the way in which Christ is despised and rejected. And yet he's the divinely appointed means of salvation, deliverance and peace for his people. This is God in his sovereignty, choosing the weak to shame the strong. Doesn't the Bible say that Christ crucified in weakness was yet the power of God to salvation? Now coming back to verses 4 to 11, we're told how the elders of Gilead, they realize in the end, well, Jephthah is their only real hope against the threat that is posed by the people of Ammon. They set about recalling him from his banishment. And they offer him a limited role as their military commander at verse 6. Come and be our commander, that we may fight against the people of Ammon. Now clearly they have an urgent need for such a man. And however reluctantly they may have come to their decision that Jephthah was the only real choice, he is the choice. But this man, this sort of outlaw leader, proves himself more than a match for the delegation of elders. And he wants to extract maximum personal benefit from this unexpected change of fortunes. Now, verse 7, Jephthah replies, Did you not hate me and expel me from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you're in distress?" And it unfolds that Jephthah wants a greater position, a greater authority than that of military leader, verse 9. He wants to be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And furthermore, Jephthah wants more than words, verse 9. Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivers them to me, shall I be your head?" For Jephthah, victory over the Ammonites will be God's endorsement of his right to rule. And the elders of Gilead agree to this request. Verse 10, "The Lord will be a witness between us if we do not do according to your words," they say. And in fact, the next verse, verse 11, reveals that even before the battle with the Ammonites begins, the people are so relieved to have their leader, glad that the elders have succeeded in their mission to bring Jephthah back, that they confirm him as civil head and commander before the Lord in Mizpah. The people made him head and commander over them, we read. So they have their leader. God has heard their cry. His heart's been moved with love and pity towards his covenant people, in spite of all their stubborn rebellion against him. But the leader they've chosen is one who's really more interested in personal position and prestige than he is in God's people. He's driven this hard bargain because he's more interested in being ruler than he was to rule. And the nation continues in its downward spiral of sin. And their sin had a price. They get a leader, but in a way, it's the leader they deserved. Sin has repercussions, individually and corporately. It matters how we live. If we continue in sin, like Israel of old, God may deliver us, but there's no substitute for obedience, because sin leaves scars on our lives. The prophet Jeremiah reminds God's wayward people in his prophecy in chapter 2 and verse 19. He says this to them, "Your own wickedness will correct you, and your backslidings will rebuke you. Know therefore and see that it is an evil and bitter thing that you have forsaken the Lord your God." And the words to take note of there are evil and bitter. There's a law of spiritual cause and effect built into God's universe. We reap what we sow. God will restore. God will freely forgive. But better to walk in obedience to him than to turn away from him. Better to walk in the light. Because if we walk in the light, it will save us from much bitterness and grief as God's people. Let's come to verses 12 through 28. These verses are in many ways two different things. They're a history lesson, that's clear. But they're also a lesson in theology. So hopefully there'll be something here for those this morning who are both budding historians and also budding theologians to learn. What we discover in these verses is that Jephthah is not only a mighty man of valor, a mighty warrior, he's also a very shrewd diplomat. Because he begins his campaign against the Amorites not by mobilizing his army, but by negotiating with the enemy. And verse 12 tells us this. He sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon. And he does that for a reason. He does it because he wants to find out the cause of Ammon's aggressions. And he says, "What do you have against me that you come to fight against me in my land?" And by taking that initiative, Jephthah is occupying what we call the moral high ground. He's occupying a position of moral strength. Jephthah may be a mighty man of valor, a warrior, yet if there's a peaceable way forward to avoid conflict, he's evidently more than willing to take it. Now the reply that Jephthah receives from the king of the people of Ammon in verse 13 is all about territorial rights. Things don't change much, do they, if you think of the Middle East today. It's all about territorial rights. This is the reason, he says, for us wanting to wage war against you. Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and to the Jordan. And he goes on to say to them, restore it peaceably and there'll be no need for warfare. Now Jephthah's reply is long and detailed, as you can see. And he begins by giving a review of what actually happened all those years ago. That's in verses 15 through 22. I'll praise it for you. In effect, he's saying, you know, before we go any further, let's get the facts straight. By the way, that's a good thing to do, isn't it, in any dispute? To try and establish the facts. And sadly, often, as we know, it isn't done. People come with their entrenched positions, which may be wrong, but they're not interested in hearing the views of others. They're rather like the king of the people of Ammon here, who wanted to rewrite history, and he wanted to rewrite it for his own ends. But Jephthah gives here a historical account, a true account of what had happened. And he tells the king here how, after leaving Egypt, Israel carefully respected both Edom's and Moab's land rights. And indeed, he says, they expressly asked permission of both to travel through their respective territories, their respective lands. And when that provision was denied, Israel didn't act in retaliation, but rather they circled around Edom and Moab, verse 18. They went along through the wilderness and bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab. Now, at this point, verse 19, they then petitioned Sihon, king of the Amorites, whose headquarters were at Heshbon, for the privilege of passing through his land. And Sihon responded to them, not by sending them a written refusal, but rather by waging war against them. He gathers an army to attack Israel, verse 20. And the resulting conflict ended, verses 21 and 22, with the Lord giving the Israelites this mighty victory over Sihon, in which they gained possession of all the land of the Amorites. That was the true story historically. And it had implications. Implications that had direct bearing on the king of the people of Ammon's claim that this was his land. Verse 13, notice, my land that the Israelites were possessing. God drove out the Amorites, verse 23, and Israel possessed the land of the Amorites. So the land at that time belonged to neither Moab nor Ammon. So why does the king of the Ammonites think it's his land? It wasn't his in the first place. It was Amorite territory. So the king of the Ammonites either had a poor memory or he was seeking to rewrite history for his own purposes. That's the historical angle. The theological part of the argument is clearly, verse 23, the Lord God of Israel dispelled the Amorites. He gave Israel Sihon's land as a gift. And so Jephthah says, in effect, you know, you'll have to be content, he says, with whatever your god Chemosh has given you. Verse 24, will you not possess whatever Chemosh your god gives to you, he says. So Jephthah's argument here rises first from history, then it proceeds on to the God of history, to the spiritual conflict between the living God and false idols. Chemosh was the god of the Moabites, who were the original owners of the land. Remember, he's one of the gods who had been worshipped by the idolatrous Israelites, chapter 10, verse 6. The gods of Moab are included in their pantheon of gods, in their list of idols that they'd embraced. If he had any power at all, would he not have used it to keep his possession? That's what Jephthah kept saying. Would he not use it now to retrieve it? And the implication clearly is that Chemosh is powerless. He can't do anything. He can't do anything because he's nothing. But Jehovah is the living God. Because the psalmist tells us that in Psalm 95 and verse 3. The Lord is the great God and the great King above all gods, with a small g, idols. So the battle that's to follow was clearly a battle between the false religion of Ammon, which had plagued Israel for 18 years, and the cause of God and truth. And at verse 27, Jephthah says, I have not sinned against you, but you wrong me by fighting against me. May the Lord judge, render judgment this day between the children of Israel and the people of Ammon. Now the king of the people of Ammon, we'll look into this further next time we come to this chapter, God willing. You see, he doesn't heed the words of Jephthah, verse 28. The king of the people of Ammon did not heed the words which Jephthah sent him. So what we see is this: Jephthah's account of history, which was true, and also his theological argument that the Lord God, the sovereign Lord, had been at work on behalf of his people, fell on deaf ears. The king of Ammon had no time for Jephthah, nor for his account of history, his faithful account, and nor for his God. And in closing, we can say this, can't we? It's no different today, is it? It's no different here in this land. The God who's blessed this land, God who over the centuries has raised up mighty preachers of the word in this land, the God who in his goodness gave this land great social reformers, God who blessed the peoples of this land, who gave us great victories in battle too. We know that. Think of the time of the Spanish Armada. God blew with his wind. It was a miraculous defeat. At a critical juncture in World War II, God's people prayed. And there was a turn in the tide. But God is derided, God is forgotten, and more than that, God is attacked without mercy on every side. But though that is so, God is still the great God and the King above all gods. And he's still working out his sovereign purposes. Now, of course, the world, unbelievers, laugh at the idea of a God who knows and a God who rules. Jesus said, this God knows the very number of hairs on our head. Ridiculous, people think. This God who saves rebellious, sinful people. But this God is our God, and he will have the last word. Read Psalm 2 later. The attempts of men to overrule and to unseat the sovereign Lord. You're told in that psalm, he who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. The tables will be turned. And what we need in these dark days in which we live is a true understanding of history, just as Jephthah had a true understanding of history. Because one thing is absolutely certain, according to the word of God this morning. This world stands between two great events. The first coming of Christ and his second coming, his returning glory. And all history is heading towards that. And God is working his purposes out. As the hymn writer says, as year succeeds to year. We should never doubt it. We should resolutely follow our great commander, the Lord Jesus Christ. And we'll continue to look at the remainder of Jephthah's judgeship next time, God willing. Verse 29 there of chapter 11 to chapter 12, verse 7. But for now, let's take heart in the fact that God is on the throne. God is working his purposes out. As we sing our final hymn, which is 455, and as we look forward to the ultimate triumph of God and his coming kingdom. Let's sing that hymn, 455. Father, let thy kingdom come. Let it come with living power. Speak at length the final word. Usher in the triumph hour. Verse 5, break triumphant day of God. Break at last our hearts to cheer. Throbbing souls and holy songs. Wait to hell thy dawning here. 455.